Welcome to Chapters, the podcast where we hear the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. I'm Mary Mahoney, and today I'm talking with Deb Bowen, a psychic who has conducted thousands of readings for people all over the world since 1983. Deb is an author and co-host with Samantha Fay of Psychic Teachers, a weekly podcast where listeners tune in to hear about everything from ghosts and energy vampires to chakra cleaning and spirit guides. Today, we're going to hear how the books she's read have helped her to understand the world and her place within it. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today. As I said, you are one of the hosts of A Psychic Teachers, a podcast that has 100,000 listeners a week. And actually, I became aware of your podcast this past year when a close friend of mine referred it to me, and I so enjoyed listening to you and Samantha. And something that really struck me when I was listening to your podcast was how much reading seems to come up in your conversations about intuition, about all of these skills that everyone has that people can tap into if they become aware of it. So I reached out to you, and you very generously agreed to be on this show. So I'm looking forward to learning more about you today through your life as a reader. So if you don't mind, I'm wondering if we could kind of start at the beginning, and maybe you could. don't look too scared.
I have 3 pages of notes here, Mary.
Oh, wow.
To do it linear. And so we'll try.
Okay, great. So maybe you could just start by telling us a little bit about where you're from, and maybe your early life as a reader, your earliest memories of reading.
I grew up on Wrightsville Beach, North Carolina, in a house on the ocean. So my life is very connected to water. I grew up with a daddy who fished and clammed and oystered and crabbed, and that's what we ate for supper a lot, was fish and black-eyed peas and bluefish and cornbread, you know. So I grew up in a wonderful little world in a little tiny, at that time, sleeping beach community. I don't remember learning to read. My mom read me a story every night before we went to bed. I loved old fairy tales, of course, and that sort of thing. My first memory of making sense out of words on a page was in a hymnal, standing on a pew in church. And I can still see her finger standing next to my aunt. And she was pointing out the words as we were singing them. And it just made sense. There it was. And I was very, very young, maybe 4 or 5. So I don't remember really learning to put all that together. I could read before I went to school. I mean, certainly I could do that. I also got in trouble for writing in cursive before I was supposed to.
So anyway. Yeah. Does it amaze you that they don't teach cursive now anymore in schools?
It infuriates me. It absolutely infuriates me. I am really old school about things like that. But in any case, I always had a book in my head. When I think back about grammar school and the books that most influenced me then, The Chronicles of Narnia. And interestingly, and I think I may have been in the 3rd or 4th grade when I first read those books. I have this ritual. I love ritual, and I think it's a really important part of our lives, is to create those meaningful moments in our lives. And so one of my rituals still today, many, many, many years later, is that during the week between Christmas and New Year's, the last week of the year, I reread the Narnia Chronicles.
Oh, wow.
Every year. I go to Narnia at least once a year.
You can't see our audio engineer, Taylor, but she just put her fist up in the air. She totally agrees with you.
Yeah. Oh, thanks, Taylor. I'm glad we're together.
Yes. But what can I, maybe if we can stop for a second and think about these books, what was it, can you kind of remember it all? What was it that so captured your imagination about those books?
First of all, C.S. Lewis is a brilliant writer. And I love, even as a small child, I understood that these books were allegories for the way we treat each other and the way we go through life. And it's an interesting thing that I'll talk about when I talk about the next book. but that beings in different ways could in fact live together in harmony. And so even then, at that early age, that notion of connectedness of all beings that you've heard me talk about on the podcast a zillion times, that was one of the foundations for that belief. You know? And Aslan's way of, if your listeners don't know who Aslan is, they should, of course. But, but Aslan's way of saying to the people of Narnia, I'll get this started and I'll help, but really it's up to you all to work this out. Yeah. And he did that over and over again, and he would just disappear, remember, and he'd show up again 100 years later and that sort of thing. I also learned how the importance of forgiveness from the Narnia Chronicles, the way that Peter and Susan, for example, forgive Edwin, you know, for what he's done, you know, and that the Winter Queen, Jada, was who she was for a reason. So it really made me stop and look at why folks do what they do and how we can begin to communicate and to live in peace together. So those were some of the lessons I got from Narnia. And still every time I reread them.
And it's really wonderful to think too about books that we return to time and time again, that we get to read them differently. So in a sense, we're reading a new book each time.
Because you're different.
At least that has been my experience. Yeah, because we're different. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. The second book at about that same time that dramatically influenced me. And interestingly, it's on my bedside table right now. I reread it in preparation for this conversation. Is a book called The Witch of Blackbird Pond.
Oh, yeah.
You too?
Deb, hold on to your hat. I'm from Wethersfield, Connecticut.
Get out.
Yes, that's where I was born and raised. And that is where the book is set. And that is where the author lived, incidentally.
Wow.
How odd, Deb.
See what I mean about connection.
Deb, what is going on in the universe that we are together talking
There's bound to be a reason, Mary.
I hope so. Yeah. Wow. I can't believe that. That's amazing. Because normally when I was growing up, I also loved that book too. And no one has heard of it as I've gone to college and grad school. Very few people seem to know about it, which shocks me. But so I'm sorry. What is it about that book that interests you?
It's still in print. It's still in print.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can. Again, that was one of those books about tolerance, and it taught me that's really when my quest for looking at different spiritual beliefs began. I wanted to understand what Quakerism was all about. You know, I loved Hannah, and you love Hannah, you know, and I wanted to learn about who are the Quaker people? What do they believe? Why were they persecuted by the Puritans?
Yeah.
Whatever would cause people to live like the Puritans lived? Where did that rigidity in their beliefs come from? What's wrong with laughter and spontaneity, you know?
Yeah.
So, and again, tolerance for people who are different from you, you know? It also sent me on a quest of learning about the Caribbean. I mean, I wanted to move to the Barbados, you know?
That's great.
Yeah, so those were two of my really early influences.
I think those are really important books because, to me, Witch of Blackbird Pond is kind of part of a larger trend of books that young girls sort of are drawn to about strong female characters who in some way don't fit in their world because of qualities that are not understood at the time or they don't feel understood in their lives. So, I mean, for people who haven't read that book, it's about a young girl who moves to Wethersfield, Connecticut, and she's accused of being a witch in the colonial period, and then she has to deal with that. It's a very broad summary, but so in many ways she's perceived as different because she is a questioning person, she's a creative person, she's smart, and she's not afraid to show that. And so it's interesting to me that you're drawn to that way too, and that you learn tolerance from that. That's really neat. That's really cool. And how odd too, that you would have read that book. I love that book because when I go home to my parents' house, you can walk around Old Wethersfield, which is where a lot of the colonial homes are. And Deb, you may do this someday, and you can feel as though you're walking through the book, going through those spaces.
How about that? Isn't that wild? Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
So where do you want to go next, Mary?
So how old abouts were you when this was happening, when you were interested in this book?
This was third, fourth grade.
Okay. So what kind of books were you into a little bit older than that, like the next period of your life?
The next, well, then I went through that thing of you're supposed to read the classics. So I read Dickens. You know, I did. Okay.
Not a fan, Deb.
Well, no, I have to tell you, Mary, I'm not. But, you know, it was okay because, you know, they're those classics you're supposed to read, and I read them. But the year I was 12, Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird came out.
Oh, wow.
I was 12 years old. I was a child in the Deep South. And that there were many pieces of that book that were reminiscent of my mother's childhood. My mom and Scout were the same age. And so it took me back to her generation. But of course, it was a time in my life. It was the early 60s. It was a time in my life where what had happened in the 1930s in To Kill a Mockingbird was happening again in the South. We were, Dr. King was coming to prominence. Kennedy died. I read that book in the summer, and Kennedy died on November 22nd of that same year. So it was a very powerful book to me in a lot of ways. I also have a ritual with that book. A couple of things. I own a first edition.
Wow.
A hardback first edition of To Kill a Mockingbird. And so I was talking to Samantha about that the other day, and she said, have you had it appraised? And I said, no, you know what it's worth. You know, it's worth all that money to me. You know, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But I also have a paperback edition that is held together with a rubber band because the pages are so torn out. You know, you just read it one at a time. And that's another ritual book for me. Where we live in the summer when the first tomatoes come off of the vine. I make a gooey tomato sandwich, as my grandma would say, all mommocked up with mayonnaise. And, isn't that great phrase?
It's wonderful, wonderful.
And I make a glass of lemonade, and I sit down with that tomato sandwich and that lemonade, and I open that book. And I
wow.
am back in Mayberry, you know, Alabama. I also was, I do a little theater, community theater.
Yes, I read that on your website.
Isn't that
wonderful?
Fun? I have the best time doing community theater. And a couple of years ago, one of our companies here did a production of To Kill a Mockingbird, and I played Miss Maudie.
Wow.
And it
wow.
was wonderful. And I was so honored to be in the show. But there's a really lovely scene where Maudie is explaining to the children. And it's in the book. It's verbatim from the book. But she's explaining to the children why what is happening is so important and why perhaps they're making just baby steps into race relations back in the 30s. Well, when we rehearsed that scene the first time, the children who were playing Scout and Jim and Dill, I burst into tears. And they looked at me like I was nuts.
Wow.
Why are these words so powerful to you? So when we took a break in rehearsal, I called the children together and I said, I am so glad that you didn't understand why that scene was so powerful to me. I'm so glad that we have moved some in a world where you didn't get that. Unfortunately, you need to get it, you know. And so
yeah.
I explained to them again. And then after that, their reactions were very appropriate to what Maudie was saying in the play. So To Kill a Mockingbird in my early teen years was really.
Can you remember? I mean, it's kind of interesting to think about a book that we now accept to be part of our American literature canon. But when it first came out, of course, nobody thought of it that way yet. We didn't know what it was. Can you kind of remember when you read it at the time and maybe what other people said about it? And I guess I'm just curious, like living in the South, you know, what did you witness about it? Yeah.
You know, here's a black man who's raped a white woman, you know, and it didn't, that was a taboo subject. I mean, if you know the story of Emmett Till or.
Of course, yes.
You can see that played out in reality. So it was a very controversial book when it was written. And I guess one of the things I'm most grateful for is my parents never censored my reading. Never. I was never told you can't read a book.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I'm curious about that because I know, I hope you don't mind me referencing this, but on one of your episodes of your podcast, you tell a really wonderful story about, I think you're having a conversation with Samantha about whether we pick our parents. Mm-hmm. And this was an idea that you fought for a long time.
I did indeed.
And you told this really wonderful story about being a child of the 60s and never really having fights with your parents, but you were in your bedroom playing We Shall Overcome on your guitar.
That's right.
And maybe you can share the rest of that story.
Oh, yeah. I was sitting in the middle of my bed playing We Shall Overcome on my guitar, and my father, who was always a very respectful, kind man, a lot of dichotomous behavior, you know. Mm-hmm. And he for the only time in my life he ever opened my bedroom door without knocking, he slammed the door open and he said, "Don't you ever let me hear you play that song again." And I looked at my father and said, "Okay, you will never hear it, but I won't stop singing it."
Mm. Wow. And so it's interesting to think that your parents didn't censor your reading, and in a way that was such a beautiful gift that they gave to you, because inadvertently it gave you the tools with music, with other things in your life, to help you create yourself, even if that creation was something they didn't understand necessarily.
Absolutely. Yeah. They didn't understand, they didn't like it, but they always gave me that freedom. I think I also shared this story on the podcast. When the Beatles went to India, you know, the Beatles go to India and they come back and they're talking about Maharishi's this, and we're talking about Buddhism and Hinduism, and I'm in high school at this point, and so I came home and announced to my father I was going to be a Buddhist. And my sweet little Presbyterian daddy said, "Then just be the best Buddhist you can be."
Wow.
You know, so you see, we got, you know, it was just a very different way. It was inconsistent, my parents were, about stuff like that. But it did, again, it gave me that freedom to explore, you know.
Yeah.
I ended up not being a Buddhist, a lot of respect for Buddhism, but, mm-hmm. But you know, I was 17 and it was okay that I was exploring that. And I think he also was wise enough to know that if he had said, "No, you are a Presbyterian and a Presbyterian you shall be," well, he would, then that adversarial relationship would have gotten even more difficult.
Yeah, totally. And it's so wonderful, the stories about To Kill a Mockingbird. And I kind of keep hoping too, hearing about you speaking to those kids in your play, that, you know, the book will continue to have that effect, and that young readers in particular will still find it, because as this conversation has kind of hinted, these conversations about race are ongoing, and certainly still a lot of conversations need to happen. And I hope that book continues to touch people the way it seems to have touched you.
I hope it does too. And in my mind, these conversations that you and I are just having about tolerance and about race and about standardized religions all laid a lot of foundations for me for how my spiritual path evolved.
Hmm.
And I'll talk about that more when I talk about some of the other books later in my life. But there's no separation for me in what I believe spiritually and what I believe in terms of connectedness and honoring of people of all different faiths and whatever.
Hmm, interesting. So what were the next kind of books that really left a mark on you?
Also during that same high school era, I was reading the biography of Jean Dixon, the psychic from Washington, who's the woman who predicted Kennedy's death. That's the thing she's most famous for. And the woman who wrote her biography is a woman named Ruth Montgomery. And in the process of writing Jean's biography, Ruth herself became open to and interested in the whole world of psychic phenomenon, and she did some automatic writing, and so Edgar Casey. So I was reading a lot of that kind of work.
Could you explain maybe for our listeners what automatic writing is?
Yeah, it's a scary thing. It's not something that I have ever been good at. But it's the ability to just go into a deep meditation and let information from the other side come through your hand as you're writing.
Oh, wow. Uh-huh. Have you done this?
Not successfully. And there are lots and lots and lots of cautions to folks about doing that, because you don't really quite know who's coming through. So you want to be sure you're really protecting yourself if you're going to do something like that.
Sure. Yeah. So what led you to that biography in the first place, do you think?
Well, you know, that's the other side of the coin. Is I grew up with a mother who herself was psychic. Her talking to dead people was not unusual in our house. She and I had a lot of psychic connections. It is not fun to be a teenager and have a psychic mother.
Yeah, can you talk a little more about that?
Yeah, I get it. Teasing. Yes, you know, I never got away with anything. Let me just put it that way.
She always knew.
She always knew. She always did. However, her psychic ability was different from mine. She, my grandfather, for example, would come during the night and sit in her bedroom, and they would have conversations. His spirit would come and visit her, and she would talk about that at breakfast the next morning, the same way I would say, oh, I talked to Mary on Skype yesterday.
Oh, wow.
She would say, oh, Daddy came last night and we sat and chatted for a while. I mean, it was that commonplace from her perspective. The telephone could ring and she would know who was, not only would she know who was on the phone, sometimes she would know what the message is. A quick story about that. My grandfather had a sister who lived to be 102, I think, maybe. And she had a daughter who was in her 80s and who never married. And these two old women lived together, you know, in another city a couple hours away from us. And on a Sunday afternoon, my mom was standing at the kitchen stove frying fish. The telephone rang, and, you know, it's one of those phones on the wall in the kitchen. My mom turned around, dropped the spatula, went to the telephone, and she did not say hello. She said, Etta, is she dead yet? To which my cousin, who was in her 80s, replied, no, she's waiting on you. You need to come now.
Oh, my gosh.
So Mama turned off the stove, and we got in the car and drove 2 hours away and visited with my 102-year-old aunt. And she and my mom chatted for a few minutes, and then she died.
Wow.
But what my mom had said, because, of course, I asked my mother, and I said, how did you know? And she said, because when the phone rang, I turned around, and Aunt Ann was standing in the kitchen. And she said, that's how I knew.
Oh, wow.
You know. So being curious about that kind of stuff was not unusual. I also, in those days in high school, had friends who we went ghost hunting back then, you know, places that purported to be haunted. There's a lovely little church where we live that is haunted by a woman who sits up on the platform there at the altar and plays an organ that isn't there. And she was the first ghost I ever saw.
Wow. What was that like?
Well, it was fascinating. And I must have been about 16. And, you know, we snuck into this church at night. You know, you're not supposed to do that. And she's what we call an imprint haunting, in that she probably does that same behavior night after night after night with no awareness that there's anyone else there or any other dimension or reality. And so we just stood and watched her, and then she just faded away.
Wow.
So that led me to my early interest in psychic phenomenon. You know, so that's when I started reading Edgar Casey and Gene Dixon and some of those things. I think Seth Speaks came later. But then I want to just talk about that a minute and then come back to another book about the same time that was totally different. But where we lived, that was that interest in psychic phenomenon was not, there was no literature to be found on it. The only books we could find from those days were books entitled things like The Black Arts. We were interested in that. We really weren't. And it wasn't until that, what became known as the New Age movement in the early 80s came forward, that we really began to be able to have books and people really opening up and channeling and writing information on a lot of this. So it was a wasteland of information, and we were hungry and thirsty for information. We knew there was more. We knew there was more out there than the worlds we had grown up in, and I'm talking about my group of friends and I. And yet we didn't have those resources available to us yet. So it was a process. So what happened to me at that point was and I had always known about my primary spirit guide, who is this big, tall, native man. And I gave him the name Morning Star when I was a very young child. And I asked him if that was okay, and he just rolled his eyes at me. He still rolls his eyes at me a lot. I used to describe him to my mother, and she would say, okay, honey, you know, okay, whatever. She just listened to that. But he has been with me all my life, and I've always been able to see him.
Hmm.
And so I'd always had this interest in First Peoples. And if you're from the South, we have a joke in the South that if you're from the South, you've got a Cherokee princess somewhere in your family background. Well, Mama always said we did. I sure don't believe it and don't know that it to be true. And interestingly, know very little about the Cherokee people from here in my own state. What I was called to learn about were the Lakota people in South Dakota. Hmm. And in 1970, Dee Brown wrote a book entitled Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee.
Yes.
And Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. Interestingly, Buffy St. Marie wrote a song about it, which the Indigo Girls did. That they did a great job of. The song tells the story of the book in 4 minutes really well. Anyway, I devoured Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And I said to my father, this was another one of those, okay, this week I'm not going to be a Buddhist. This week I'm going to South Dakota and be a school teacher on a reservation. No, you're not, he said. No, you're not. It's not going to happen. Well, it didn't. And it took me many years to get to South Dakota and to get to my teachers on the reservation. I look back on that sequencing of events now and understand the logic and the reasoning that spirit was moving and to make the sequence happen the way that it did. And it's okay. But after reading Dee Brown, then I began to devour anything I could get my hands on about Lakota people. Most of what I got was written by white people. I quit reading books by white people about Lakota people. I don't read those anymore.
Okay.
I think one should, if you're going to read about a people, you ought to read what the people say about themselves. So books by Joseph Marshall, books by Mary Braithbird are my favorites in the learning about the Lakota folks. But anyway, that was another one of those connections of spirituality and social justice where I said I'd come back and pull that together for us. This is one of the ways that happened for me, was here I'm reading about a deeply spiritual people whose everyday world is governed by how they see their world of spirituality and connectedness. You've heard me use the phrase Matakiasi, which is Lakota for we are all related. So here are a group of people who are so firmly related, grounded in their spirituality, and at the same time they're fighting a political battle with the American Indian movement. And so out of the civil rights movement with African American folks came, of course, the women's movement and a lot of other movements, as well as AIM, American Indian Movement, and their takeover of Alcatraz and the Bureau of Indian Affairs office, and of course then their takeover of this tiny little village in South Dakota called Wounded Knee, which really falls on a creek where the shape of the creek looks like a knee. So I was also interested in how one, again, that piece of the puzzle of putting spirituality and political activism and social justice issues, again, came together for me in yet another way as I was reading that work. And that has continued in my relationships with my friends on the reservation.
Oh, wow.
I've talked too much.
No, not at all. I mean, do you revisit that book now having been to South Dakota? Does it change your reading of that book?
Some, although, like I say, I don't read white people books anymore about the Lakota people. I
read
books that my friends have, because I've become friends with writers from there. So I read their books instead. And
yeah.
That gives me a different perspective.
Now, was this a time in your life when you maybe, I guess you said before that you were aware of your kind of psychic gifts as a child, but at what point did you start to kind of pay attention to them, or were willing to pay attention to them and kind of hone it?
Certainly during the 70s, as this same time period where I think Seth Speaks was probably the first of the channeled books that people began to be aware of. Shirley MacLaine was starting to write some of her early books.
Of course, yes.
You know, and I'll get to Out on a Limb, which I think came out in 84. And that was a real pivotal book for me. So we were reading some of these kinds of things. We were reading Siddhartha, for example. I think I'd certainly read that earlier. I was reading a fellow named Tom Robbins. Do you know who Tom Robbins was?
No, I don't.
His most famous book probably is Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. But we were reading Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. He wrote a wonderful book some years later that's still one of my favorite books called Jitterbug Perfume. And it's about how if we really wanted to, we could bring back the old Greek gods into real prominence if we wanted to do that. It's a fascinating little fun.
How would that work? Like, what does he say? Yes.
You have to believe in them.
Oh.
Gods only die when they have no one to believe in them.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
It's really simple, you know, that sort of thing. I'm looking at my notes here.
Sure.
The other piece of that 70s puzzle was reading Mary Stewart's series of books on Merlin.
Oh, okay.
On Merlin legend. Mm-hmm. And those books are The Crystal Cave, The Hollow Hills, The Last Enchantment, and The Wicked Day. I'm not real fond of the last one, but The Crystal Cave and The Hollow Hills are two of my all-time favorite books. And when I read The Crystal Cave and The Hollow Hills, and the scene where Merlin disguises King Uther and takes him to Tintagel Castle up on that cliff for to have relationships with Lady Igraine to so she could bear King Arthur, I stopped breathing. I knew I was home. I was reading about a place I had been before.
Oh, wow.
And so that book was one of the books that led me to really begin to research reincarnation.
Oh, wow.
Again, it was one of those things. Not only did I have to go to South Dakota because I knew I had lived there before. I know I had. I also had to go to Cornwall. And the first time I stood on that cliff at Tintagel, I sobbed. I was home.
Wow.
I had
now, when you say that you had been there before, what does that mean to you?
It means that I had awareness of, it was so familiar that I knew that I had lived there in a past life.
Wow.
I mean, I just knew I had. I just knew I had.
Wow. So the book helped you to access a past life, and the first time that even a consciousness that you had past lives.
That's what Wounded Knee did, bury my heart at Wounded Knee. That's what that did in those past lives that I had in the Lakota world. And then that's what Mary Stewart's Merlin books, the Arthurian books, did for me in Cornwall.
Wow.
I knew I'd had lives in both of those places.
Do you think it's possible that other people reading books who have that kind of feeling, like, oh, this, I'm reading, say, Jane Austen, this feels so familiar to me, I almost feel like I was there, that beyond just connecting to a book, there could be some other more loaded spiritual meaning to that connection?
I absolutely believe that. You know, I think that when we read a book and we like it and we resonate with the book and we can visualize the landscape, for example, or, you know, that's good writing, I think. But when we have a a visceral reaction in our solar plexus or in our heart chakra, for example. And not just because it was a pretty love story, you know, but there's something about this that is about intrinsically who we are. When, for me, a lot of times it's smells, it's fragrances. When taking my story about Tintagel, for example, I knew what it smelled like before I got there. And I knew, and I could smell it in the book. You know, I knew what it would feel like to walk out on that cliff and climb those stairs up to that castle.
Wow.
I already knew that.
Are there any books that you've had connections to that maybe if you could speak to the author and wonder if they have that connection too?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh yeah, there are probably many of them, you know. Let me think about that one for
sure,
a few.
Sure.
When you start to think of an author, the author's names go away, you know.
No, of course, yes. have you ever had a visceral reaction to a book very negatively, but also with the knowledge that because it connected you to something in a past life, but it brought up negative things for you?
Not so much in a past life, but certainly in a way of looking at the world and issues and spiritual issues and psychic phenomenon that I don't want to have anything to do with. For example, books written by and about Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are demonologists.
Okay.
Yeah, no. I'm not going there.
Nothing to do with demonology.
Not a thing in this world. Nothing. You know, talk to Samantha about that. Don't talk to me about it. There's a place in Utah called the Skinwalker Ranch.
Okay.
And if you Google it, it's kind of frightening, the stuff that comes up. And there have been a couple of books written about Skinwalker Ranch. And I remember reading one of them. My friend Joel and I were reading it at the same time. And we're on the phone talking and saying, what page are you on? And, you know, and do you believe this? You know, we both got to page 59 and said no more. Absolutely no more. We will not read any further. And I couldn't do it. I had a visceral reaction to a phenomenon that was, to me, was so foreign and so frightening that I just wouldn't go there.
Fair enough. Yeah. I probably wouldn't go there either. So I think I brought you a little off track, but
it's okay.
What other books, where were we at in your story?
We were in the 70s, early 80s, and I want to go back to, you know, that question of if you were on a deserted island, and you could only take one book, what would it be? Question.
Sure. Okay. Sure.
My answer to that is Illusions by Richard Bach.
Yes. I've heard you speak about this book.
Tiny little book. I don't know. It's fine. Maybe 150 pages. It's a tiny little book. And it's not all text. They're, you know, it's not. And I love that book.
What is it? Maybe you could just give a quick description of what it is for people who are unfamiliar with it.
The subtitle is Confessions of a Reluctant Messiah. Yes.
That's a very loaded subtitle.
Isn't it? Richard Bach is probably best known for his book called Jonathan Livingston Seagull. They made a movie out of that. But this is my favorite of his books. It's the story of two, and you get the time frame is indeterminate, but probably 40s, 50s maybe, of two fellas who fly biplanes. Taking people for rides across cornfields in Iowa. That's how they make their living. One of them is learning about connection to spirit. And the other fella whose name is Richard, already has been a messiah. He has done this gig before down here on Earth. And he's agreed to come back for a short period of time to train Richard, but Richard doesn't know this. And Richard asks questions like, how come there are never any dead bugs on your windshield? You know, and Richard the Messiah guy goes, well, you know, there's no need in killing bugs. You just don't have to do that. You know, you'll learn this. And you learn about time and space continuum and the reality of or non-reality of time and of space and what is what we think of as being solid. And it was illusions that led my way into studying quantum physics.
Oh, wow.
Because, and now let me be real clear. My study of quantum physics has not gone well. But
I think you get credit for trying. I think you get credit for trying.
Well, where that went for me was the idea of looking at what we think of as reality with our five senses and knowing that that isn't real. And physics tells us that everything is energy, that there's really no me and you sitting here talking, that we just really are energy forms vibrating at a particular rate. You know, one called Mary, one called Deb. And that even these, all this electronic stuff we're talking on vibrates at a particular rate. And so that's a physics concept, but it's also a spiritual concept. Because when we can understand at whatever level I can understand it, that it's all about vibration, then we're back to my Lakota folks concept of Matakiasi, and we all are all related, and there's really no separation among us. Wow. So again, it's that connectedness for me that comes in these books. So Illusions gave me that gift. It also reinforced that wonderful thing that Jesus said, that, you know, anything I can do, you can do. Jesus said that. And that gives me hope. That gives me some faith. I don't know. It isn't so much that I can do it, but that I don't believe that necessarily. I think that's ostentatious and presumptuous to think. But I do believe that what comes through me can do miracles and give people hope and help people. And so that's what I think that illusion, another thing that illusions taught me.
So did it help you kind of figure out your purpose or start to articulate why you think you're here and what work you should be doing?
It at least helped me not to feel so terribly resistant to it.
So you did resist this gift.
Yeah, who do I think I am?
Well, I guess I'm just, because you grew up with it. So maybe I thought it would be seem more normal to you.
It was normal. And I did grow up with it. But it was something that was just normal in our house. It wasn't like me talking to 100,000 people on the radio every week.
Right.
Or, you know, or doing readings or doing spiritual coaching. That was a different world. And so when I got my first tarot deck, and I have to tell you, back in those days, until just this whole new age world has become such a cash cow and a big business thing. But before that, the belief was you weren't supposed to buy a tarot deck. If you were meant to have tarot, tarot came to you, and you couldn't ask for it. You just had to just wait. And I saw my first psychic in 1982, and she told me then I should be reading tarot. And so I wasn't even real sure what tarot was. I mean, you just sort of heard of it, you know. And she opened the doors to numerology, and we had some conversation about learning astrology, and there were a lot of other things that she suggested. But I thought, well, okay, we'll see what happens. Well, a week or so later, a friend of mine who had been in Chapel Hill, which is a 2-3 hour away city and bigger and kind of cooler than where I live back in those days, certainly, walked into my house, and he said, I don't know why, but I was in a bookstore and these jumped in my hand and I was to bring them to you. And he brought me the deck I still use today, the same deck and a book, which is still, it's kind of my go-to kind of book. And so for a year I learned and I memorized and I studied and I took all those, it was the traditional Waite Rider deck. And so I took all those wonderful symbols of all those different cultures, which another thing that Tarot does for me is it brings together. I'm right back to that idea of connectedness, because on any given Tarot card, you might see Christian symbols, Greek symbols, Egyptian symbols, Celtics, I mean, you know, Hebrew, yeah. Hebraic symbols, you know. So again, that's another way of bringing connection for me. So for a year, I read for myself and I read for friends, and I would read to them out of the book if they promised not to believe me. And I went back almost a year to the day later to see the same psychic. And when I had had no contact with her. And when I walked into the room, she said, "I see you've gotten your tarot cards. Now throw the book away and trust yourself." Well, that wasn't going to happen. I probably bought 100 tarot books since then, but I did, and I never learned to trust me. I still don't trust me, but I trust what comes through me. Hmm. I trust that connection to that source that's up there somewhere. That, you know, and there have been times where I have said a prayer for a reading and laid out and started to lay out the cards and thought, what if nothing comes through? What if I don't get a thing for this person? That has never happened. That's never happened. May not have necessarily been the message the client wanted, but it was the message Tarot needed to give.
Wow. And is Tarot your main means of accessing messages or other people?
It has been for many years. It has been for many years. Within that context, some things have shifted for me. I'm now able to talk sometimes to folks, pets on the other side, that's kind of triggered through laying out the cards. Now, rather than reading the cards literally for their meaning, they now have become more symbolic for me. And the messages that come through come more from my spirit guide. I hear the message more from my guide than I do see the cards in front of me. I even now, and I've been doing this since, like I said, the early 80s, I still feel more comfortable having those cards in front of me.
I believe it. Yeah, I probably would too. So it doesn't clutter your mind in the sense that you can kind of go about your life and tune in and tune out. Like, you're not at the grocery store and you suddenly feel compelled to tell the cashier, "I'm sorry, but I have to tell you no. X, Y, Z."
I have really good boundaries when it comes to that sort of thing. I would never go to the grocery stores when my chakra's open. It's just not going to happen. I joke about this with Samantha. I'm like, really? You know, people go to the Walmart with their chakras open? I mean, do you know what kind of stuff you absorb? That's crazy. Don't do that. So no, I'm very good at opening and closing those seven major energy centers so that, you know, yes, I can, you know, clean the house and go to the grocery store and do normal stuff. And no, I can't read minds. I don't want to read your mind. I'm not the least bit interested in doing that. You know?
That's a relief for me. Yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all. So it's not like I walk around being psychic 24 hours a day. What I do think is really, really important is my meditation practice. Without that, and there are messages and information that come through, not necessarily for a client, but just for things that I'm learning and studying and that are really important for me to get that information. And it comes through meditation and through my contact with my spirit guides.
Hmm. So the tarot cards help you to read other people and in a sense read yourself. But I'm wondering if there's other books too that help you to, in your practice of maybe air quotes, reading other people.
Yeah, I have a list.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, I thought you might ask that question. There are. Shirley MacLaine's book, Out on a Limb, gave me, she really opened, bless her heart, she was such a pioneer, because people thought she was crazy, you know. No,
yeah.
No, here she is. She's absolutely nuts. But that really did open the way for a lot of people to say, this happens to me too. These kinds of synchronistic things happen to me. And Shirley really paved the way for that. Another person that has been, and I've been studying consistently since the 70s, is Carl Jung, and his perspective on spirituality and psychology and psychic phenomenon. And interestingly, Jung used Tarot in his work as well.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Uh-huh. He did. And in fact, he built a tower on his property that was modeled after the tower on the Tarot cards. That was his place of study as well. I read about alchemist, you know, and not necessarily that I believe literally that one can change, you know, lead into gold, although that would be fun. And if, you know, that would be nice. But from a metaphorical perspective of that alchemical process. So I love Gualto's book, you know, The Alchemist. I love that allegory as well. And I have to tell you that another, women. Let me talk about women before I get off on, I was going to go off on Harry Potter, but I won't do that. The divine feminine, because remember when I talked about, you know, the African-American civil rights movement and the Native American civil rights movement, well, then, of course, there was the women's movement. So I read this, you know, I can't tell you how many zillions of books from the women's movement I read. And there are still some today that I reread and that are still important to me. Women Who Run With Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
Okay.
I've never been able to sit down and read that book all the way through. I have to pick it up and put it down and pick it up and put it down. And fortunately, it's written in a way that that's okay to do that. But that book was extremely powerful to me, as were Jean Shinoda Bolen's books. Jean wrote a book many years ago called Goddess in Every Woman, where she looked at, and it's Jean is, are you familiar with her work? Do you know her?
No, unfortunately not.
She's a Jungian analyst who lives in San Francisco. And so her early work was very Jungian influenced. And her Goddess in Every Woman looked at Greek and Roman goddesses as archetypes of who women are today. Hmm. Wonderful book. She wrote another book some years later, and I'm skipping a lot of her books, but another one that's really powerful for me is Crossing to Avalon. And so you see, I'm back to my
Merlin. Yes.
but her Crossing to Avalon was about women in midlife crises. Hmm. And so that Avalon becomes both literal in that she does go to Glastonbury and to Cornwall and she does that literally, but it's also a metaphor about how Avalon becomes a sacred place and a safe place for women's mysteries.
Hmm.
More recently, Jean has taken that notion of spirituality and feminine spirituality and again moved it into the political and social justice realm with a great book called it's a long title. Urgent Message from Mother, Gather the Women, Save the World.
Wow.
Isn't that
what a title. Yeah.
I know. Right. Jean is also on the Women's Rights Council for the United Nations. So there's a lot. She was instrumental in International Women's Day, which was March 8th, by the way. So I've read a lot of her work, and that has and continues to inform a lot of what I believe. And two of the underpinning books in that realm of women and that whole notion of women and power. Well, let me give you three. One by a woman named Merlin Stone. The name of the book is When God Was a Woman. And she follows, it's an anthropological, an archaeological book where she traces the matriarchy back thousands and thousands and thousands of years. So When God Was a Woman by Merlin Stone. The Spiral Dance by Starhawk, which gives us the resurgence of the goddess religion around the world, and particularly here in America. Starhawk lives in California and also has an organization called Reclaiming, which is an organization about taking care of the earth. And then Margot Adler, who died just a couple of years ago, wrote a book that that is still a textbook, basically, called Drawing Down the Moon, where she traces paganism and how it has evolved to become neo-paganism, particularly in America. Margot Adler, as I said, died a couple of years ago. She was a reporter for National Public Radio. She was an NPR reporter.
Margot was. Oh, okay.
Yeah, so if you'd recognize the name, you may recognize it from NPR.
Right, yes.
She was also a pagan. And so those three books really did that resurgence of the goddess community. Interestingly, Sue Monk Kidd, K-I-D-D, who you know Sue, I can tell.
Yes.
Sue wrote The Secret Life of Bees, which is probably the book that most people are familiar with for her. It was made into a wonderful movie. And in that book, she talks about the Black Madonna. And again, it's another one of those books about social justice. There is another thread that runs through that book. But Sue wrote another book called The Dance of the Dissonant Daughter. Hmm. And it's her journey into finding her own spirituality outside of the realm of the traditional Christian belief she grew up in. And it's very much like Crossing to Avalon by Jean Bowen, and then Sue Monk Kidd's The Dance of the Dissonant Daughter. These are women who are finding their way into spirituality that worked for them in their lives. Hmm. And so I love that.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems like a really powerful thread through a lot of your reading life.
It is. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's interesting that you picked those books, but I'm thinking a lot about, before our conversation, I was thinking a lot about this idea of intuition, and do we choose books or do books choose us at different times in our lives? Do you think both?
I sure do. I have been in bookstores. This happened to me not so terribly long ago. I was in a bookstore and had picked up a couple of books that I was going to get. And I got to the cash register and there's this book I didn't remember picking up. I thought, okay. I don't know. Maybe I was looking at it. I don't know. So I went back, put it back, wandered around, did a couple of other things. Thought, oh yeah, I forgot I needed to get this. And so, you know, I get back to the cash register and the book's in my hand again. Now I know I put that book on. I know I did.
Wow.
Well, the second time the book shows up at the cash register, I just held up my hands and said, okay, all right, okay. I get it. And I bought it, you know. And it was a book on astrology that I wouldn't have particularly been interested in. It turns out that the man who wrote it was the son-in-law of the first psychic I saw.
Wow.
I know. that kind of stuff. So, wow. Yes. And I've certainly over the years had people bring me stacks of books and say, here, you need to read these, you know, here, read this. Samantha and I trade books all the time. I mean, as you can well imagine, we're forever reading things that each other suggest. Sometimes they're too light and fluffy and pink and Samantha-ish for me, you know. She can go there with some of that. She likes, for example, she likes those little murder mysteries that are solved by women who own, I don't know, cupcake bakeries and things like that. And they're fun and I enjoy them, you know, but I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on them. As you can probably imagine, I'm a voracious reader. There's a different book on in every room in my house that's open, and depending on what book room I'm in, that's what I'm reading at the moment.
Hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you want to know what they are right now, just for fun?
Sure. Yeah. Tell me.
On my nightstand is The Witch of Blackbird Pond. On the kitchen table is a new book. It's a novel called A Man Called Ove, O-V-E.
Hmm.
And my local bookseller recommended it to me. It's written by a Swedish author, and I'm enjoying it. I'll let you know later what I think when I'm finished with it.
Yeah, please do.
In the den is a book on sacred geometry that I'm also working my way through. And in this room where I'm sitting right now on the table behind you is the Gospels of Mary Magdalene.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Hmm.
So that's what I'm reading right now, those four books.
Wow. Sounds like you have a really rich reading life going on right now. What was the last, what other books would you recommend to our listeners? What was the last great book that you read?
Oh, good golly. Let me check my list. Let me check my list. Oh, The Woman with the Alabaster Jar.
I haven't read that.
It's Mary Magdalene. It's about Mary Magdalene. I've been on a Mary Magdalene kick. I've undertaken a course of studies on the Celtic pantheon. We know about Greek and Roman folks, right? You know, but I realized I needed to learn a lot more about the Celtic pantheon. So I've been reading books by Christopher Hughes. The most recent one of that is From the Cauldron Born.
Wow. Maybe I'll discover another past life, Deb.
Oh, I know those. You know about some of those. I know about a lot of my past lives.
Wow.
I mean, I do.
That's amazing. And I know,
it is. And I also know that there are parts of the planet that I don't resonate with at all, that I don't have any connection with. I also have places on the planet where I've had past lives that I never want to go again.
Where would that be?
Germany.
Oh. Do you know what time period?
Yeah, World War II.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and I have, if you said, gee, Deb, thanks for being on my show, here's a free plane ticket to Germany, I'd say, no thanks, Mary.
Well, don't worry, we don't have the funding for that, so that definitely won't be happening. But oh my gosh, that's very intense.
I wouldn't go. And it's interesting, because I know I died in Germany in World War II. I also know I died at Wounded Knee, South Dakota. And yet my heart aches to get back to Wounded Knee. As painful as that death was, there was also some wonderful things. I think I died very young in World War II. I think I was very young.
You were a child.
I think so. Or a teenager, maybe.
And am I correct in recalling, I think I heard on an episode of your podcast that you had a past life in which you were beheaded? Were you living in a harem or something? Am I getting this totally wrong?
Well, you're almost right. It was it was my lover who was beheaded.
Oh, my.
Yeah, he had his head chopped off in that lifetime. And there were others where I did lose my head. You're right.
Wow. Wow. That's a lot to live with. The memories of those events or the thoughts of that. But I'm wondering, can you remember reading in any of your past lives?
Well, that's a great question. I don't know that I can. I'll ask my guide about that.
Yeah, please do and get back to me.
I will.
That'd be fascinating to hear about. It's interesting because it'd be interesting to think if your interest in books changed in different lives, which is what I would imagine, or if there was a through line or a book that kept showing up or something like that.
That's a great question. I'll ask the guide about that.
Yeah.
So I hope this has made sense in some way.
It has totally made sense. And it's been utterly delightful, if I had to pick one word. And I hope that if you ever make it to Weathershield, Connecticut, you will let me bring you on a Witch of Blackbird Pond tour.
You're on. I would love it. I would just love it.
Completely unsanctioned. It will just be led by me. But it would be delightful.
And if you come here to the sunny south and want to do a ghost tour here in my town, I'll be happy to do that for you.
Deb, don't toy with me, Deb. I might take you up on it. I would be delighted. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, thank you so much. This has been amazing.
Thank you so much for having me. I certainly enjoyed it. And yes, we will stay in touch.
I would love that. I would love that. Yeah, I feel like, I have more book questions for you or recommendations. So you'll be hearing from me. Yeah.
All
wonderful.
Right.
Well, have a great day. Thank you so
too.
Much.
All thank right.
You. Bye-bye. Bye. You too. I'd like to thank our guest, Deb, for sharing her story with us. Visit our website, www.chapterspod.com, if you'd like to share your story on Chapters. We are dedicated to sharing the stories of readers' lives through the books that have meant the most to them. On our website, you can also find links to every book mentioned on this and every episode. You can follow us at ChaptersPod on Twitter and find us on Facebook. I'm Mary Mahoney, and you can follow me at MaryMahoney123. I'd like to thank our technical director, Taylor, who engineered and produced this episode and also wrote our theme music. She can be found on Twitter at MJTThePhD. Thanks for listening to Chapters.